Hello, Fairbanks. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We're at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at KFARradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Prus. This is not a live show, so we're not going to be giving out the phone number today. It's a pre-recorded show. I have in the studio with me here Matt Halala. He is running for governor. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. So privileged to be here in beautiful Fairbanks on a sunny day.
Yeah, it's Fairbanks. It's a Friday. He's up here for our wonderful past. It's Monday, but he was up here for Golden Days, and I saw the opportunity. And hey, it's me. I want to introduce a very good potential gubernatorial person here and introduce him to Fairbanks. How you doing?
Wonderful.
So let's, you know, I like to go through your background first. You're born and raised, well, you were born in Anchorage.
Right.
Just due to circumstances of that having a big hospital.
Right.
Where were you raised?
Initially Nikiski until I was about four, then Kenai until I was about eight, and then Soldotna. Between Soldotna and Sterling is where our home was. And
okay. Small town.
Yep, small town. Where I met Stacy, my wife of 35 years this summer, actually in about 2 weeks.
Man, Stacy, this is like doing hard time, but what the heck? You took one for the team. Good for you.
Yeah. So we're Peninsula people originally, but we went out and went to medical school in 1991 and returned in 98 from being in Chicago and D.C., and we couldn't relocate to the Kenai Peninsula because of the size of the medical establishment down there. It was too small. And we moved back to Anchorage. And so I have been in practice in Anchorage and Wasilla for the last 30 years.
Yep. You've been busy.
Yep. Just retired this last October from practice.
What did you practice in?
Foot and ankle surgery. Actually, everything below the knee. So I'm a podiatric surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
So our degree is the Doctor of Podiatric Medical degree. So it's a four-year medical school like everybody else, and then it's a three-year surgical residency after that. So
a lot of bones down there.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating because I enjoyed physics a lot, and it's all about physics and biomechanics, and I really enjoyed it. It's very, very tactile, very tangible, and it's also procedure intensive. You know, you have an opportunity to fix things with your hands rather than just reading labs and, you know, diagnosing and prescribing things. So really loved it. But, you know, it's time to transition.
You are on the state. You are still on state medical board?
Yes.
Yep. Appointed by Governor Dunleavy?
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, during the pandemic, it was very interesting. I was reading an article in the Anchorage Daily News about a group of about 100 or 120 physicians in, I think, around the state. It was primarily South Central Alaska. We're urging the state medical board to live up to their responsibility as they saw it, to pursue and sanction physicians and providers that were writing for ivermectin, hydrochloroquine. They stated that these physicians were promoting misinformation, disinformation, and harming the public. So I reached out to the governor, and in that article it said there was one vacancy on the board. So I reached out and said, you need me on that board, someone with common sense and courage to stand up to this bullying. We have a fairly libertarian state with regards to medicine. And by the way, I'm speaking for myself, not the board, on this topic today. But fortunately at the time, we had like-minded individuals on the board. And we had responded to that letter because it was urging us to start doing something. And that the answer was that we look at individual cases and complaints of harm as an individual situation. We don't do dragnets on the community. And an unconventional practice, if it is not unethical or unprofessional in Alaska statutorily. So it's a good thing. It can be a little bit of a challenge, but as long as patients are well-informed through informed consent, that should be their right to make decisions for themselves. And I'm a huge advocate for that. And at the time, our board was also advocating for that stance, and we unanimously signed a letter to that effect to the media and to the public. So I'm very proud of our board.
You stood up. Yeah, you stood up.
Yeah.
We're not going to be pressured or bullied.
Exactly.
For good medical sound practices, too.
Right, exactly. But, you know, it's funny because standard of care, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's not standard of care. Standard of care is very elusive. And in one region of the country, standard of care is different based upon specialists that you have easy access to, et cetera, and in other areas not. So we're concerned about, you know, a from on high dictum saying this is standard of care, like from the central, you know, the federal government. We really do need innovation and the ability to have some liberty there in deciding on medical care. So
how many people are on the medical board?
It is 5 physician members, 1 PA, which is reserved for PAs because we regulate the physician assistant practice. And there are 2 lay members of the board.
Yeah,
so it's
open
8
position. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're down 2 or 3 members right now. So I may have to resign from the board just because I'm going to get too busy.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have to abide some ethical considerations while campaigning, but I'm not going to step down right now because it's important that the board can achieve a quorum with critical emergency meetings and things, because we deal with danger issues with people that need to be unfortunately suspended and to protect the public. So I do anticipate, though, being able to step down from the board.
You're a member of the Republican Party.
Yes.
Have you been active?
Yes. Yeah, I've filed as a Republican, I think when I was 18, right away.
I filed as a Democrat.
Yeah.
And then by the time I was about 20, I was filing as an independent.
Right.
By the time I was 24, I was filing as a Republican.
There you go.
So I went full gamut.
You went the whole, if
the
you're
whole,
young, you're young and you,
yep.
you're a Republican.
Follow thy father, follow thy father.
Right.
And then I didn't realize that my dad was, he left the Democratic Party too, and he became an independent.
so. Yeah. Well, today's Republican Party looks a lot like the moderate Democrats of the 1960s.
Yeah. As my dad was.
But so at 18, I followed this beautiful girl.
Hi, Stacy.
Funny, intelligent, beautiful. Down to Oregon. And I really didn't know what I was going to do. I went to the University of Oregon in Eugene.
Mm-hmm.
And it was culture shock. I had dorm mates that were chaining themselves to trees and logging camps, being arrested. Very radical. It was like the 1960s at Berkeley at the University of Oregon. And I was a conservative kid.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what made me a more firm Republican and conservative, is I could not articulate my beliefs as an 18-year-old. And I was being taught things by the professors that I knew intuitively were not correct, right? And at times, I felt like an idiot because I was trying to debate with my peers and I could not adequately do that. So from that moment on, I did return. My future wife returned to Alaska, and I did too. Finished my undergraduate experience at UAA in Anchorage, of course. And I engaged aggressively in trying to better myself and to articulate my conservative viewpoints. And I was listening to this loud guy that my parents had on the radio, 6:50 a.m. back then, 1989. And at first, I was a little irritated by this guy, but then I started listening and like, hey, I wish I had said that to those people down there in Eugene. And it was Rush Limbaugh. So quickly I became a ditto head. I think I was the only kid in our medical school class with my clinic coat on with a ditto a lapel pin. So I, you know, I was a Reagan supporter and Bush and everybody. And so I've become more proud of my beliefs because I can articulate why I believe them and why I think that we're better as a society to have some of these positions. So, so that's my educational process and how I've, when I did return to Alaska, Republicans started to mentor me. Dr. David McGuire was very active. And he said, Matt, if we're going to support you in practice because you appear to be worthy, actually he scrubbed cases with me to make sure I knew what I was doing. Early on, he said, You need to be involved in the community. You need to go to fundraisers and support good candidates, because if you don't, others will, and you might not like the outcome.
There you
so
go.
So there we are. So we've always been a supporter of the Republican Party all these years. Sullivan, Begich, in the very beginning with everybody else, Murkowski, 04. Things have diverged a bit, but we supported Kelly Shabaka in the last one. And we've remained quite conservative, of course. So we're looking forward to our opportunity to be a part of it.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. We'll be back after these messages. And again, this is a tape program. We're not taking phone calls. Fairbanks, welcome back. David Pruse in the studio here with Matt and Stacy Halila. How you doing, Stacy?
Great, thanks.
Enjoying yourself?
Yes, beautiful. It's been a few years since we've been made it up this direction, so we're enjoying it.
You hit Fairbanks at a beautiful time.
Absolutely.
Beautiful time. Matt, you know, when you run for public office, you got to have thoughts and positions and things like that. But before we ever, you know, it's early for you, so before we ever go there, you have to put together a statewide gubernatorial campaign. How are you looking at doing that?
Right. Well, again, mentorship. I know that I've got a great media guy that's advising me, Art Hackney. He's doing a great job. One of the behind-the-scenes mentors, Ashley Reed, is helping a lot. We just added Ryan Sheldon to the team, which is of the famed Don Sheldon Glacier Pilot family, which is really great.
Journey with the Wind.
Yeah, he's very excited to get involved. So we are putting the team together.
Yeah.
As we announced just this last Friday, we're hitting the ground running and, you know, as evidence coming up here right away, even before I have card stock or anything to hand out, I don't even have a name tag yet. So, but I did not want to miss out on the opportunity you presented. And being here, a part of the parade, et cetera, and then being a part of the Binkley celebration tomorrow evening.
Yeah.
Like I said, we were kind of laughing that we didn't really know who the Binkleys were when we were kids, but there was a Binkley Street in Soldotna.
Ah.
And I got to ask that tomorrow night about what's the origin of that. It must have been friends or admirers. I mean, there's a lot to admire in the Binkley story. I mean, it's incredible. So, you know, it's going to take shape. But I'm relying on mentorship. Again, I'm not a politician per se. I mean, I've been engaged in politics for decades, but
you've made big decisions,
right?
Critical decisions,
right?
And what made you jump into the race for governor?
Well, I retired from practice after 30 years of founding and running a fairly large practice with 6 foot and ankle surgeons and. You know, we've employed hundreds of people throughout the years in the Matsu Valley and Anchorage. And so I did develop some administrative chops in that operation. Also, I was a managing partner of a few different surgery centers. And I was always on the boards, whether I was the chairman or not. A lot of challenging issues, confrontations, big egos, of course, surgeons, right? And to be able to diffuse the tension and negotiate something so that the organization can move forward is what I've gained a reputation for in those environments. And so people had been encouraging me. You hear the story all the time, right? You need to run for elected office. You need to run for elected office. Well, on the state med board, I was hearing that a lot too. Just standing up with courage, speaking in a manner that doesn't alienate people that you need to be supportive to come together. So, basically, I started to get to know some of the other gubernatorial candidates, and I was thinking, well, maybe I'll start small. Maybe I'll jump in like as a lieutenant governor, and that was being partially offered.
I'm starting small at lieutenant governor.
Yeah,
that's funny,
well, right? But sometimes they're not. You know, they get issued a firearm, they're protecting the seal, and they're in charge of elections, or at least you know, you know, and then. These advisors to me that are in the world, they're like, Matt, you're going to be frustrated. And I, as much as I admire most all of the other people that have thrown their hat in the ring, and I know that will, I think I have a very broad depth and breadth experience as an Alaskan. I was a commercial fisherman for nearly 20 years since I was 9. I ran my dad's operation in Bristol Bay from the time I was 18, the youngest that you could be a permit holder.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, my crew was the youngest crew in Bristol Bay at the time for a few years. We were all teenagers. And that was an experience in leadership and responsibility.
How long were you a fisherman in Bristol Bay?
Because 12,
that's real life experience. Yeah, that's real life, tough, dangerous experience.
Yeah, it was about 12 years, the first stint. And then when I did return, as my son became of age, my brother was still over there.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a permit. We went over together. And then we put the permit and got it in my son's name when he was 15. Because they allow...
Scene one, take two.
Yeah. So it was my brother and my son, and then my son has been a...
How did you talk your wife into letting your 15-year-old son join the most dangerous fishing business in the world?
Yeah, that's an intuitive question, because...
I'm looking at it right now. I'm looking at her eyes.
It was literally... I mean, it was like... So we also did the Iron Dog with him.
Okay.
When he was 17. And it was like, Stacy told our team, if he gets hurt on that trail, don't come back. Same thing with Bristol Bay. If something happens over there, don't come back, because that's the baby boy. So, but nothing bad.
Mama
happened.
Bear.
Yeah. Growth experience. And
I see you're still alive.
Yeah. So, but you know, those, I know how hard it is to make a living at fishing. I mean, there were many years where we were break even at best.
So you have experience. You're front line.
Right.
In an industry that over the last 6 years has cratered.
Right.
Literally cratered.
Right.
Your thoughts on it.
Yeah. And, you know, as a young kid, it was hard to understand where 1 year you're getting paid $2.25 a pound, and then the next year is 35 cents a pound. And everybody's wanting to go on strike. And Governor Hickel at the time, you know, even backed us up and partially shut down the fishery for a little while to try to pressure the buyers. And it's an understanding of the international aspect of that market.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a resource that, if managed properly, and I was so impressed with the management in the Bristol Bay area for sustainability. Mm-hmm. I mean, they use that commercial fishery properly to manage the escapement levels, to not over escape. They almost always achieve the minimum escapement numbers. When those fishermen go out there, we sop up 90 to 95% of all the salmon in each of those districts. When they pull us back out, they get their escapement. I mean, it's like clockwork.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know why they've not been able to do it quite like that in Cook Inlet. The big high-dollar fisheries are, like, of course, the trawlers. That's a big controversy right now, of course. And I know that's like a $1.5 to $2 billion industry, pollock trawlers and all that stuff. That was not my fishery, but I understand it a bit. I know Joe Bundrant of Trident Seafoods. It's very important to a lot of Alaskans, and you can't just shut it down with the idea that it might save a species if you don't have evidence, strong enough evidence. And I think you first need to learn more about the problem. You know, in Cook Inlet, they shut down all of the east side beachside fishermen, shut them all down, and they said, that's how we're going to save the kings. Well, 3 or 4 years later, it didn't do anything. Okay, now it's the trawling fleet. Okay, shut them down, right? $1.5 million or billion-dollar industry. Is that really the answer? When you have some evidence, of course, bycatch is a problem, right? And there are technologies that you can start looking at enforcing. If we knew where salmon went when they go out there to the oceans, and we knew their, like, migration patterns, you could get creative about corridors that are left open during that period, right, for the kings. We need more basic sciences and research done on where salmon go, what their natural diet is. It's very interesting how little we understand. I mean, it's pretty hard to tag a fry or a small salmon as they're leaving the freshwater systems to go out into the oceans.
Yeah.
And they go out there for 2 to 5 years. You know, they're two ocean, three ocean. You know, they try to label them. They've got a lot of sophisticated genetic ability to track these lines, but there's a lot to be learned. And I think that's what we need to focus on and invest in, and maybe get the trawling fishery to contribute to learning about that, to help protect the species that seems to be threatened, and they're a part of the bycatch.
Okay, let's project your governor of the state of Alaska, and you get to make a fish board appointment. Oh boy.
Yeah.
And is it going to be commercial? Is it going to be a sport? The fight's going to happen. What do you think?
You know, I think you have to have a balance because it's a resource for both sport and commercial. Mm-hmm. And the commercial and sport people lived fairly harmoniously when I was a kid down on the peninsula. And of course, that was the world capital of the Chinook king salmon with Les Anderson's 98-pound king that dried out for 8 hours, by the way, before he weighed it. And there was a pretty good harmony there. So something has changed, and we don't fully understand it. We need to understand it. But, you know, where you can have multiple members, of course, on a board, you need to balance that as much as you can with all the interests so that then you get public support.
There you go.
You can't have it an appearance of it being completely biased in one direction or the other. Then you're not going to accomplish anything.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. Again, we are taped today, so we're not taking any phone calls, and we'll be back after these messages. Fairbanks, welcome back. I have in the studio here with me Stacy Matt-Halela. Matt is running for governor with Stacy's permission, I believe.
She takes two
to tango on this, so
yep.
It really does. You know, you have a very disconcerted House and Senate that does not get along with the governor. And I've always looked at this from Governor Dunleavy's first 2 years. He had a Republican Senate, but he had a House that a couple Republicans out of the MATSU, David Eastman, would not coalition together, and was so frustrating for 30 days that some Republicans wouldn't coalition with the Democrats. And so it was lost opportunity
right. For
Governor Dunleavy his first 2 years, and it happened again. So out of his 7 years in government, he's had 2 years with both a Republican House and a very mixed Senate. And the House and the Senate really don't get along with each other.
Right.
And you're coming in saying, okay, I'm not part of the problem. What's your thought for a solution?
Well, you know, I think... you know, the House, the Chamber of the People, the Senate, the statesmen, you know, I think there's a natural competition there. You know, I ask people, you know, when was the last time there was an overwhelming majority where an incoming governor just had a easy mandate, everything was simple? It's very, very rare in Alaska politics. And I think what's slowly been happening is that we're unwilling to treat each other with respect and recognize that we can align over common goals rather than aligning with common enemies. Mm-hmm. And I think this coalition thing, the back and forth, is a loss of trust. It has to do with sometimes personal insults, people being embarrassed in front of others, behavior that's not respectful. And, you know, you can compromise on issues as long as you're not compromising on your principles, okay? And debate and even anger at times is fine. Actually, anger in a lot of studies is very healthy because anger is a way of expressing, hey, something is wrong in this relationship, but I want you to be in a relationship with me. You're a fellow Alaskan, right? But contempt is different. It raises to the level of acrimony of, you're dumb and evil. Roll your eyes, and I can't even talk to you. Well, We're negotiating some great stuff that's going to benefit all of Alaska right now, and we cannot allow for contempt to interfere with that. That's a major problem. It's across the board. It's not just in politics, of course. I mean, I was laughing yesterday listening to one of my favorite astrophysicists, Sabina Hoffenfelder, and even among these, you know, premier scientists, their main problem are personality conflicts and contempt for one another. And you'd think it's all about science, and you'd think that our legislative efforts would be all about benefiting Alaskans. So we need to cool down the contempt. We need to be master negotiators and align under common goals. And I think that we can do that. We have so much optimism before us right now. Fortunately, with Trump coming into office, a lot of these executive orders that Biden had put in place have been repealed or negated. I like Dan Sullivan's tearing of the sheet of paper he was doing over and over again about Lock Up Alaska.
70 presidential edicts.
Right. I mean, it's like an iron dome that the Biden administration, not a strategic military iron dome, but over all of our natural resource development areas.
Okay, let's cut to the chase.
Mm-hmm.
Your governor. You have Senator Bill Willikowski.
Right.
Rules chairman.
Right.
He does not like any Republican.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Well,
how do you get something that you want to do past him?
Okay. So I've got to spend enough time with him or study him a bit to start understanding upon which foundations he's basing his arguments.
Mm-hmm. And there's no argument. He just doesn't like you.
Right. Well, you know what? That's okay.
He doesn't like the R behind your name.
Right, exactly. Well, he needs to be called out. It needs to be transparent that kind of contempt is no longer tolerated, and he needs to be reminded publicly that it's very important to recognize that our argument cannot spill over into harming Alaskan families' future.
Mm-hmm.
Work is critical to the future of Alaska families.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we solve that dignity gap of people that have an opportunity to work and those that don't. And we talk about wealth divide, wealth gap, education gap. It's a dignity gap.
Mm-hmm.
And when we steal dignity from people by not providing them an opportunity for work, that's shameful, it can't be tolerated, and it needs to be spoken of and called out.
Okay, another example. On the other side, you know, I'm not a one-side pony here.
Right.
You have Senator Showers.
Right.
And you're not far right enough for him.
Right.
And he gets on his gavel and starts pounding you.
Right.
Because you're not far enough right.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Well, you know, as much as I like with Mike Showers, from what I hear and everything and I've followed, I think that that's where being in person is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Being there so that when you can have a debate, a cordial argument, you can be disarming.
Mm-hmm.
And you can gain an ally because you're allied 80 to 90% of the time. And there's a different approach to some of these issues that are so controversial.
One of my philosophies with elected people on the city council is, even if I don't vote with you today, I will surely vote with you tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. And the old, you know, it's cliche at this point, if we are aligned 80% of the time or agree, then we agree.
Yeah. Don't worry about the other 20%. We don't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And as long as we keep focusing on the future and the betterment for Alaskan families, that is my priority. I want Alaska families' balance sheets to be in the black. That is the most important balance sheet. And that means work and an opportunity to work.
On June 21st of 1977, they turned on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. I was there at Pump Station 1 when it happened. And everyone, they started laying people off. And they said, don't worry, we'll all be back in 6 months to build the gas line.
Ah, wow.
That was in 1977, 48 years ago.
Wow.
We're getting close.
Right.
How are you going to put it over the line? If you're elected, you got a four-year term.
Right.
How are you going to put a gas line over the line, over the finish line?
Okay, so it is very exciting. We all have almost mild PTSD over this because we've
we've
heard it. We got excited. I had, you know, patients in my office that were like pipeline engineers from India, and they're like, if it doesn't happen this time, it's never going to happen. Well, and then it didn't.
It's
right?
like Friday the 13th, 15th remake.
Right. We made sure it was not economic with ACEs and chanting our fair share, which is true, but there's a balance there. There's something called opportunity cost. And so I just got an MBA. I tortured myself a little bit 5 years ago and got an MBA. I call it my midlife crisis at Arizona State. And so I've learned all these fun terms, opportunity cost, NPV analysis, and all these things. And the opportunity cost is industry can go other places. They have a limited amount of capital and resource and bandwidth to deploy around the world. They've got Guyana. They've got other projects. So Alaskan gas is... In general, it's more expensive to deliver to Tidewater than many other parts of the world. And natural gas is fairly plentiful. So when you tack onto that excessive royalties or taxation that's beyond that opportunity cost threshold, industry is just not going to jump in. Something's changed, though, of course, with Trump. And Trump has reduced regulatory burden. He's unlocked all this stuff and made this a big priority. I was at the energy conference, very impressed with Burgum, Wright, and Zeldin there with our governor. And I know our governor has been singularly focused on this because he knows this is going to float all boats. A lot of arguments are going to disappear if in fact, we get this gas line. Something else has changed. It is now a geostrategic element with our allies. In a time of war, you know, we don't imagine we're still in a time of barbaric war, but we're watching Israel, Iran, we're watching Ukraine, Russia, right? And the energy issues that happened when Europe had aligned with Russia with the Nord Stream, right, that Trump had shut down, Biden allowed again, and now they're at war. Oops, that was a bad place to source our energy, Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more evidently geostrategic. We're defending Eastern Southeast Asia. You know, we got South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, et cetera. And they don't have natural gas on their property. They need to ship it in, and they can select their military ally as the place that they buy energy from. And even if it's a little more expensive than the cheapest that's on the market, it's geostrategic. So I think that's something that's changed, where like the Watana Dam for our energy needs, you know, we can do all of the above. That makes sense, right? I'm a big advocate for pursuing all energy. We need to get as much energy and abundant, cheap, or at least reasonably cost energy for Alaskans because we are on the verge of an industry renaissance, natural resource renaissance up here, and it's going to require a lot of energy. It attracts industry. So I think that just to continue where, frankly, what Dunleavy is working on, I had a meeting with him about a week and a half ago, and he's been, again, singularly focused on that. And, you know, it's caused a little controversy. He's not been as present in Juneau. I think that needs to be balanced, of course. You know, that's full court press. You've got to make these things happen.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. Again, this is a tape program, so I'm not giving you out the phone number. But I'm going to have Matt back here live for some questions. He's given great answers to my hard-pressing questions. We'll be back with more in just a few minutes. Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Matt and Stacy Halila here in the studio with me. Matt, Republican from different portions of Alaska.
Right.
That is good. I mean, it's good. Right. You know, you have a very good cross view of when you grew up, hardworking in different industries, going to medical school, bringing something back to Alaska that was tops, getting a different thought, and you went and got a master's in business administration.
Mm-hmm.
I could not have done that. I was, when I was done with my 4-year program. Right. In 5 years, I was done.
It created some anxiety. Stacy can attest to that. Oh my! It really tested my mettle to think academically again.
Uh huh.
But it was a really rewarding thing at midlife, right at 50, to do that. And it was the double purpose there is I now have my elderly parents in the Phoenix area. They were 65-year. They came up in the 50s. They had just left because they really can't do winter up here anymore.
Yeah.
And my dad had, when he was 80, he got eaten by a Murphy bed. So he was taking.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
At first, it sounded absurd, and we were kind of laughing. But in the end, it was a terrible emergency. He had pelvic fractures.
Yeah.
So he was up trying to take a Murphy bed, a big, heavy oak one, off of the wall. And he forgot about the shocks still being deployed. He had a stool on the platform, and he was taking the last screw out. He was above the top of the platform that was on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
That last screw came out, and it deployed and trapped him like a bear trap. It threw this 80-year-old 12 feet, and it snapped across his pelvis. He ended up with four pelvic fractures, first rib fracture, terrible concussion, and he almost died. He had to have blood transfusions.
Wow.
So anyways, when he did recover well enough, which was quite remarkable, we got him down to a single-level ranch home in Sun City West, and I felt the need to be there enough to push him along with his rehab. I did not want him to get stuck in a wheelchair. So I'm like, okay, guess what? I'm going to do something while I'm down there. Every 2 weeks, every 10 days, I had to fly to Phoenix for 2 years. And that was my opportunity to spend an extra day down there with them and to make sure he was on track. And, yeah. So, I mean, I owe a lot to my parents. They are a wonderful couple. You know, the nurturing side, but straight talk from my mother, a woman of courage. My father, kind of rough in his language towards us, but you know what? It was about work. You know, mm-hmm. If he caught you during the day, did you do anything productive today? You know, you got to be productive. Mm-hmm. What are you doing? And if you're out working with him, Dad, I'm getting hungry. Eating is secondary. Eating is secondary. So, you know, it was the work ethic, right?
Yeah.
And kind of the, you know, the loving brutality mm-hmm. of a dad. You know, he was very affectionate, you know, gave us a hug and stuff.
But he had a sander for you.
But he was tough. Yeah. Anyway, that's why I did that MBA.
Okay.
And there was a couple of other physicians that I respected that said it is the best thing you can do just to go hone your skills. I'd been told by people, wow, you understand a lot about business and property development and commercial buildings that I did. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I do, but I don't have formal education in this stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't really understand the fancy terminology in the boardrooms, like in the banks. And so that was a part of why I did it. I'm like, you know, I'm still pretty young. I can do this. And now it is coming in handy. So I think it's given me the confidence to pivot also.
The last 2 years, all the oxygen in the room in Juneau, because Democrats are majorities on both sides, has been education.
Right.
What's your thoughts about education? I shouldn't say what are your thoughts.
Right.
It's a my thought is you have the haves and the have-nots.
Right.
The have-nots are your municipal governments who must fund themselves and get a percentage from the state.
Right.
The haves are the unincorporated areas that are funded 100% by the state.
Yep.
What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's education, whether we like it or not, is being disrupted right before our eyes, like a lot of areas. Healthcare is being disrupted. A lot of it is, I think it was kind of spurred on by the pandemic mm-hmm. and our response. AI is a huge part of this. AI is disrupting energy, education delivery, healthcare. And literally within the next 5 years, I think we're not even going to recognize what's happening. I'm optimistic about it. I mm-hmm. love technology. That's another kind of side hobby. I read and listen constantly about this stuff. But, you know, Stacy and I are products of Alaska Public Schools, We went K through 12 in, I did in Soldotna. Stacy arrived in Soldotna when she was 9 or 10 from Oregon. But
hence Oregon University.
Yes, yes. So, you know, there's value in the public school system. Now, when we returned, I had, you know, even though we were a Catholic family, mm-hmm. in the peninsula, it wasn't really a Catholic community. Mm-hmm. We didn't have an established Catholic school of any kind. I didn't even really know what that was. So when we returned to the Anchorage area, my mother was like, oh, there's a really great Catholic elementary in Anchorage called St. Elizabeth's.
Hmm.
So our cute little daughter was 5, and she was just starting kindergarten, and that's what we did. And so I got involved on school boards. I was on the 7th grade to 12th grade board at Lumen Christi for about 12 years, and I became quite passionate about education. I think we have an obligation to our public schools and to educate students. I do regret that some of our public schools have allowed, and I call it sectarianism,
mm-hmm.
to seep into the day. And this is not the intention of public school. And it's called, you know, woke ideology is mm-hmm. what I'm talking about. So constitutionally, public funds are not to go to religious or sectarian institutions or organizations, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I looked up sectarian. Well, it's any organization entity that promotes divisive ideology. So pride flags, CRT, you know, all the stuff that's become kind of a part of the...
That's sectarian.
You know, yeah, it's sectarianism. So really that should be threatening funding, right?
Yeah.
Now, do I want the public school system to crumble? No, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I think it can be reformed on those lines. Get rid of this sectarian garbage. Get back to the basics. Allow communities to place their own flavor on the day, right? We had a great experience in our public schools. We had the ability to say a prayer before a sporting event, right? Or our pep rallies in the gymnasium led by our wonderful principal that we all loved. You know, he was a guy with a little bit of a drinking problem. But guess what? He was our principal that we loved that had a drinking problem. And I'm trying to be a little bit funny there, but it was a different era, right? It was a different era in the 70s and 80s. And it's gotten a little out of whack and out of balance. So I do think that, you know, in the Valley, Matsu Valley, it's either 1 out of 4 or 1 out of 3 families have walked away from the public school system. That's pretty tremendous.
Yes.
I mean, is it good? Well, it's not good for the situation at the public schools, but it might initiate reform. A wake-up call. AI is delivering some amazing things. At Alpha School in Austin, the AI tutor, the teachers call themselves guides. They sit and log in the student. They go through their daily module of reading, writing, all the basics, right? And the AI figures out what delivery method is most effective for that individual student. And they're scoring the top 3% of standardized tests at Alpha School. And Microsoft just released an AI-based educational platform, I think for free, a month ago. So this stuff is happening. Rural Alaska is now connected. Starlink is everywhere. They've got the highest per capita connectivity, which was wonderful. It didn't require $60,000 of fiber per home as the Inflation Reduction Act or whichever act that was. I thought that was foolish that we would be spending, you know, $80 or $120 million when Starlink is $500 a house. So there's a lot that's going to be disrupted. Again, balance. It's scary for a lot of people, but it's happening whether we like it or not. I think it's mostly going to benefit families and students, and that's the number one priority.
Matt, thank you for coming in and coming up to Fairbanks and interviewing us. This is only the first one for you with me.
Thank you.
And I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed what you have to say. I think you're going to be not only a good, but an extremely formidable candidate.
Thank you very much. I intend to be.
Thank you for coming up. Fairbanks, I will see you tomorrow on Tuesday. You have a great day.